Welcome to the best of the RSN Breakfast Club. Here's a little bit of what we did. Take a listen.
Adam White's ready to rock and roll. Good morning to you, Whitey.
Good morning.
How was your night?
It was okay.
Were you disappointed?
With what?
With the cricket?
No, I wasn't disappointed.
You weren't disappointed?
You get what you get and you don't get upset.
Well, that doesn't mean you can't be disappointed.
If you can't play well enough, well, it's no one's fault but themselves. You should be excited today anyway, Daniel, because Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, or Princess Meghan or whatever she's called,
Duchess of Sussex,
arrives in Melbourne today.
They do, my understanding is.
Now, I'm very interested to see what she bakes, because she baked banana bread yesterday for the people of Dubbo. I'm not sure what she's going to come up with today, but I'm very interested to see what it will be.
Right.
What do you think she'll bake?
I must admit, I hadn't come across my radar, the baking situation with the Duchess. I would have thought maybe a nice Anzac Bicky, just to see if she can sort out the local fare, and where she ranges in the sort of the Melbourne show type presentation of the Melbourne.
That is risky. That is risky Anzac business.
Well, yeah, that's right. But she's a millennial.
You can't. It's very hard to get that right. That it's not. It's crisp, but it's not overcooked. It's a real sort of balancing act.
You're going to have some chew about the Anzac.
Correct. That's exactly right.
Mm.
So I'm thinking more like a muffin type situation, maybe. But yeah,
you're going to make a lot of muffins if you're going to make muffins. Like it's a lot of tins, a lot of trays. I'm not sure she's got that many trays in the suitcase in the Louis Vuittons.
Well, the banana bread certainly sort of threw me. I wasn't expecting it.
Well, it's not part of the regime for us, so we don't care about the banana bread or the muffins today. And Adam Ramanauskas, we'll probably eat them all before we get there anyway, the Foot Bombers champ, who's been heavily involved in the trade scenario that particularly unfolded yesterday with him and his business at TLA. Good morning to you, Ramo.
Yes, good morning. Yes.
How did you sleep last night, Ramo?
Not that great, to be honest with you. I was still a little bit wired up at about midnight, and I was still watching a little bit of the cricket at that stage. And, yeah, I didn't sleep well. So, but
look, where were you? Were you at home on the couch watching it unfold, or were you at Trade Central?
We were in there. Yeah, we got in there, I think, yesterday. Well, we didn't get in there too early. We got in there about, I think I got in there at 5:30. A few of the other guys got in there a little bit earlier because their direct players were getting traded, so signing off on pair of attorneys and the like and doing all that type of stuff. So,
what are you doing at that time? Because I think it was really interesting. And I've got to say, well done to afl.com.au. I thought they actually did it quite well, the way that they did the final sort of day. And even just to be able to see that room where the managers or the list managers came in to complete the trades. But from a manager's point of view, what are you doing behind the scenes?
You're still finalising deals a lot of the time when you're in the room or even helping. Now, the part for us is because we're the biggest company with the most players, we can have some sort of influence to help deals move along and the like. And yesterday we were fortunate enough that the deal that we wanted done was done basically through the middle of the day. And that wasn't just, oh, we're able to do it like that. That was 3 or 4 days of really, really strong planning where we were sitting in a room at our TLA offices making sure and going through all the different scenarios and how it should work and the order of events that it needed to happen. So, look, we was a very successful period for us with the players that wanted to get traded, were able to get traded, but as always, there was a few that couldn't.
It kind of went in two waves, as you said, sort of early to mid-afternoon, the first wave went through, which essentially saw Hogan get to Fremantle, Neil get to Brisbane, May get to Melbourne. That was the one that was sort of always seen as the sort of the three-way.
But Wingard and
Wingard, yeah, absolutely. But the question I still have, and I don't think I'll ever get the full answer, is why it takes so long, considering that we were forecasting this 2-3 weeks ago, that this sort of thing would likely happen. Is it just a question of one club holding out to the best for the last possible moment until the other one blinks? Or, you know, why does it take so long?
There's a little bit of that. I think initially clubs want to make sure they're getting the best deal they possibly can, and almost in a sense they want to make sure that it looks like they're completely winning that trade. But what needs to happen is you need to actually find out what each club wants before you can then go back and perform the trade. So once we were able to find out what each club wanted in Brisbane, in Melbourne, in Fremantle, in Hawthorn, in Port Adelaide, that's when you're able then to establish, okay, we've got all the assets now. Let's put it all up on the board. Let's write it all up. And let's make sure that every club will come out of this with exactly what they want and they feel like they're all a winner.
So you have a whiteboard?
We've got multiple whiteboards in the office.
Interesting.
Multiple.
There's been a big discussion in this office about the merit of a whiteboard half.
Yes, well, the boss is still waiting for the whiteboard that you've pinched from him to be taken back to his office at some stage.
I felt half looking at the overall picture. When you see who won and who lost and what the trades are worth, I reckon all of them were fair. I don't think there's anyone where you think, oh, God, they got absolutely stuff there. I feel that, you know, most of the key players have gone for effectively 1.5 first-round draft picks.
Yep.
You know, in the case of Beams, it's two late first-rounders. So if you're trying to put, you know, the points to it, Neil, Beams, Scheel, Wingard, we're all traded for about the same price.
Are you doing that, just by the way? Are you doing the points calculator when you're putting these deals together? Is that what you do?
Sometimes, because, look, the points are really important when clubs have got academy picks, father-son picks, all that type of stuff. So that's where the pick swap between North Melbourne and Fremantle became really important yesterday. So, you know, Fremantle wanted a second-round pick, and we had to go and find that for them. So we're able to do that. North Melbourne wanted points, and we're able to provide them more points. So
this is what I love, the fact that you're doing it. Like, the clubs don't worry. They just hand it over to the agents and say, right, you do it. Can you sort this out for us? That'd be great. We really appreciate that.
And that's the hard part, is that clubs can get in the room together, so two clubs, but when it comes to multiple clubs getting in a room together, I think that's probably where the issue lies, because
you become the intermediary or the whatever it's called.
Yeah, you do.
Is that the word?
Yep, that's one of them. So Steve Rosich, Jake Nail's telling me today that Steve Rosich, the CEO of Fremantle, who was heavily involved through this period because they don't currently have this manager, or they didn't before Peter Bell took over, rang your organisation, rang Tom Petruro around midday on Monday and said, mate, can you sort this out? We've got all this stuff that we need to happen. You manage most of the world. Mm-hmm. Can you sort this out? So we got the club bosses bringing you guys to actually make the trades happen.
Yep.
That's true?
Yep. Yeah, that's true. And you know, if that's what it takes, that's what it takes. Because, look, sometimes a singular trade from club to club is reasonably straightforward a lot of the time and can get done pretty quickly. But when it's multiple clubs and picks flying around everywhere, you do need, it's almost like you need a lead person on that trade. And that lead person then, like I said a little bit earlier, once they understand exactly what every club wants, you're able then to go about your business and make that all work with shifting parts.
And there's still going to be potential changes to the draft order.
I think there's still going to be big. Yeah. I still think there's going to be big changes to the draft order over the next couple of weeks.
So they can change, they can trade draft picks until a week before and then on the night. Is that right?
Yep.
Right.
You know what I reckon should happen as well? And I think it will happen in time, is that the trade period will be open-ended for months.
Like a window, like the window.
It'll stay open until, my view is it should stay open until mid-February.
Mid-February?
Yep.
What for?
Because we talk about, you know, what your list looks like and all those
things. You'll be bored in 3 weeks.
Yeah, but I think it takes out the frenzy, it takes out the intensity if it's just, it can be done over a period of time. So I'll use the example of Sam Doherty, that Carlton loses Sam Doherty for the year before Christmas, and essentially, you know, they could have done something in a sort of a delisted free agency capacity, but they couldn't trade or they couldn't do anything. They were just stuck. But there's no reason, in my view, that there needs to be, apart from for footy cards or for media capture days and all that sort of stuff, there's no reason why a list lodgement deadline couldn't be, you know, mid-February, and you couldn't trade up until that point. If you lose players through the pre-season, or if, you know, guys get homesick or whatever the case may be, I think it should go right the way through. Now, we've got a situation here with the draft picks. This is, I think, at the start of this, where right up until draft night, including draft night, you can actually start to look at picks. It takes the intensity out of it, and people can make measured, unemotional decisions over a period of time with these things.
Does that not fly in the face, though, of your long-held theory that the art of list management is to get your list done by the due date, and then and survive through the year?
Well, but I think this is a almost like a compromise that you can make your adjustments until close to the season starting, but once the season starts, you can't change it.
I still think whatever the deadline is to a trade, there'll be still a frenzy on those last
There probably will be, Rama. And that happens in the Premier League where it's open for an entire month. Mm. That's a reality. But I think that, you know, I like to use that Sam Doherty example as a good one, is that, you know, that completely changed Carlton with one of their best players at an All-Australian going down. And they're stuck, really. They couldn't do anything about it.
Effectively, what clubs think is that when it gets closer to the deadline, the buyer is always going to give more, depending on how desperate they are.
Well, that's what the Giants are thinking yesterday with the Bombers.
No doubt. And I thought Essendon gave up a fair bit for Dylan Scheel yesterday. I thought that was...
Well, how could have they done it differently?
So they should have, by the
way. There was a couple of other... Essendon definitely put a couple of other scenarios to the Giants that I thought were all fair and reasonable.
Yeah, but I think when you look at
Essendon... It's a fair haul that they gave to the Giants.
I think when you look at Essendon, it's more the fact you see their draft picks. Their first pick isn't until 34, and they don't have their first round next year.
Next year, yeah.
That Adrian Dodoro wouldn't be overly happy about that. You know, as it stands, they only have three picks in the draft, whereas if you sort of measure that up against, say, a team like Adelaide... Now, admittedly, Adelaide didn't bring anyone in, and they did lose Mitch McGovern, but they've got picks 8, 13, 16, and 21. Now, they can do a lot with that. They can bundle those together and try and get higher up the order and potentially get one of those highly touted Adelaide players.
Well, the Giants obviously lost a lot in this trade period, but they've got 9, 11, 19, 25.
Yeah.
So if you look at the big winners from a draft point of view, it's Adelaide, it's GWS. Port Adelaide got 5, 10, and 15. They'll only use those three picks. So,
And I think that's the thing that, I mean, you can say that about the Giants, but they've lost Scheel, Lobb, and Scully, and Setterfield. So it's a horrific time for me, as far as I'm concerned, with the Giants.
The human spirit is an amazing thing. It creates and achieves great things. And on the weekend, when Lee Shivers completed the Hawaiian Ironman, he did so on the back of an amazingly distressing and heartbreaking 12 months. But he crossed the finish line in a little over 9 hours, and it's a huge performance, and we want to talk to him about it. Lee joins us this morning on The Breakfast Club. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning.
Great to have you on, mate. We really appreciate your time. Firstly, how have you recovered from the Hawaiian Ironman?
Surprisingly well, actually. I think the adrenaline probably probably hasn't worn off yet. I couldn't sleep very well the night after, which is sort of strange to think that you can't sleep after doing nearly 10 hours of exercise. But I think just so much adrenaline and probably a fair bit of caffeine as well to get through the race, and couldn't sleep very well. But probably the worst of it, I've got about 3 or 4 toenails that are hanging on for dear life at the moment, cool. And a few achy joints and a few sore knees. But I'm pretty good otherwise. Pretty good.
It's an amazing achievement. For those that don't know your story, I'm sure there are plenty that do, through your story on the Australian story in the ABC, which has covered it pretty well. This time last year, you were married with 2 sons. Unfortunately, since that time, your wife Sarah and your son Alfie, who is 18 months old, have both passed away through brain cancer. Now, as a father myself, and happily married as well, I can't imagine what that would do to a person's soul and spirit, but somehow you found a way to harness some energy and get yourself back on track to doing a Hawaiian Ironman, let alone get your life back on track. How did you do that, Lee?
Yeah, well, look, I think, it's not just me. I guess there's, you know, huge family, Sarah's family and my family as well that's been supporting us. But, you know, I'll give a lot of credit to Sarah and Elfie here. You know, Sarah, and my wife, who passed away in January, and Elfie in June. You know, they were both inflicted with different types of brain tumour, but the way they carried themselves and kept fighting and smiling throughout their disease, just, I guess, you know, I had to keep going for them. I suppose I couldn't, of course, you want to curl up in a ball and lie in bed all day, but when you've got, your 2-year-old son there who's in hospital and kicking his little leg and wants you to read him a story or have a play or listen to some music with him, that's going to get you out there and, support him and do whatever you can for him. So I think really it's the motivation comes from them, really, if I had to put it in a word.
So when you were doing what you were doing in the Ironman, is it something that you would think about often when you were struggling, or how did you get through that 9.5 hours?
Well, I remember when I first got off the plane, Hawaii is iconic because of the heat and the wind. That's why the Ironman here is so impossible. You get off the plane and you walk about 50 metres and you're already starting to sweat. And then, you know, after about 100 metres, you start to drip with sweat and you're just going, I don't know how this is going to be possible. But if you talk to a lot of the professionals and everyone here, you know, it is about putting, one foot in front of the other. And that sounds really, really simple and really ridiculous. But I think... really just focusing in on what you're doing at that time and just putting one foot in front of the other until hopefully at some point, and have faith that at some point you will finish if you just keep doing that. And, that's the simplest strategy. There's a lot more that, goes into it in terms of keeping cool and keeping hydrated as well. But, just putting one foot in front of the other and, being grateful that, Darren Elfie, who couldn't be here with us, I'm healthy enough and well enough to be here and be here with my son Hugh, and we're having an absolute ball, and keeping that gratitude that you're actually healthy enough and well enough to do it. So I hope that answers your question.
Always nice to have Glenn McFarlane with us from the Herald Sun. Back again, plenty happening in the world of footy and a bit of racing as well, which is all across. Good morning to you, Magga.
G'day, Half, Rammer and Whitey. Primetime brinkmanship. We love it, don't we?
Hey? Primetime brinkmanship. I can't believe that you're wearing your Dane Beams jumper in here today.
Well, I'm just not sure what number to put on the back, because they've got to work out a new number and sort through those issues. But
what's left? What have they got?
There's not a lot left, but that's okay. I'm happy to take whatever, and not sure what's happening with Sam Murray, so that number might be available. So,
that's a good point. I haven't thought about Sam Murray for a while.
Yeah, so that number might be, hopefully very soon we'll find out what's going on there.
So we don't know any more just on Sam Murray? Because it was a B-sample requirement.
Correct. We've heard yet.
Which don't normally take this long.
No, it's taken a while, and we know that he was in the rooms after the grand final, in the lead-up to the preliminary final in the rooms and the like, and which we all checked, and you're allowed to do that until the B sample comes through. So we're just waiting to hear on that one. I would suggest it wouldn't be too far away.
Would they be happy, the Magpies, with what happened through the trade period,
maybe? Yeah, I think so. You had to give up a bit to get Dane Beams, but to get Dane Beams, and I think to get Jordan Ruffhead is a good get as well. It's not going to get anywhere near the coverage that Dane Beams...
I reckon they got
Beams.
Him in a steal.
So do I.
Premiership player.
Good person.
Multi-position player.
Yep.
Oh, I can't work out why the Bulldogs don't like him.
There's a little bit of Lee Brown about him going forward, I reckon, when Collingwood were able to bring Lee Brown in and he can play a number of different roles. Hopefully Jordan can do the same.
Yeah, that was...
What do you reckon, Rabbit?
That's odd for me.
Backup. I think it's very much backup, ruck. Allow Mason Cox to play a lot more forward rather than going into the ruck. To help Brody Grundy, maybe a little bit as a defender, but I think it's more backup for Grundy.
I think it's an interesting one with Collingwood when you look at Beams coming in, who I still think is in the best 20 players in the competition.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
He's sort of been off the radar a little bit in the last couple of years because he's been in Brisbane. But you've got Beams, Wells and Elliott and Moore into that team that missed out on winning a premiership by a goal.
They got enormous depth. If they can get if they can be injury free, they got enormous depth now, Collingwood.
I'm getting excited now.
that is quite extraordinary, though, when you think about it.
It is. It's as good a midfield. They had the best midfield, I think. Probably
didn't about that
this year, and it's just going to be even better next year.
Pendlebury, Sidebottom, Treloar, Adams.
Who goes out?
Grundy. You throw DeGoey in there if you want to. There's one other one that I knew I'd forget.
It's an extraordinary Sidebottom who. It's a question of how you fit them all in, but as Rama was sort of suggesting before, you just let them get through the middle and switch, and they'll be an outstanding midfield group next year, no doubt at all.
It's a conversation a bit for another day, but I'm still trying to work out on the success of what they were able to achieve this year with the players that they had and the personnel and the system they had. whether or not those players, and the ones particularly that have been injured for the whole year, basically, come back in and have the same level of impact. I just don't know if that works like that.
Well, Wells can play forward. You know, so Sear will probably be a midfielder, which will push side bottom to wing half forward. He could play forward to go. It's just... It's scarily good.
Well, I'm not convinced that they're the answer. The guys that have missed out. I'm not convinced.
No, I'm not saying that. But there's a bit of X factor about a couple of those.
You're convinced on Elliott is or Wells as well.
More Wells would have been just icing in that grand final. Mm. More particularly, if you look at the grand final in the end, as brave as Tyson Goldsack, yep, and who was the other
Jeremy Howe
as they were. That's not their go-to play on those type of players. And in the end, Darling and Kennedy take 19 marks between them, and I think 10 of them were contested. So, you know, that's they've got to come back into the team.
Yeah, and there's a
and that's why, in a sense, sorry to, to jump in, Macca, I actually thought, as good as Dane Beams is, and I love him, I think he's a super, super player, Stephen May probably would have been more important than Beams to come in for Collingwood.
Well, yes. But they didn't get him, but they still get a premium.
Well, the romance of getting Beams back.
And I think there's a lot to do with that. The romance of Beams. I think it was the decision they had to make when Beams indicated to Collingwood quite some time ago, we believe, that he was pretty keen on
best
coming back.
Best and fairest winner.
Yeah, absolutely.
Premiership player.
The interesting scenario is, and we saw him talk quite emotionally last night, he's had his personal challenges, as we know, and I think to be back in Melbourne will be good for him. But he also had his challenges with Nathan Buckley as a coach when just before he left, he had some issues with Nathan, and he freely admitted last night that he had to work through, will have to work through those as he goes through. But we know that Nathan's changed a lot as a coach, as a person, and I think it's just a good closing chapter in his career going back to Collingwood.
Interesting. Wells will be 34 next year. Mm. Elliott hasn't played for 15 years, and Darcy Moore's unproven. I'm still trying to work out how that makes them better. We'll work it out. Now, tell me, Tim Kelly, what's the situation with Tim Kelly? Why didn't that get through?
I think two footy clubs, who are two pretty proud footy clubs, who believe they had to stand on their dig to get what they had and what they require they needed. I think Geelong, and Scotty Gullen, we've got to give him credit for this as well. He said very much at the start of this trade period, this deal will not happen. And he was very strong on that. And both clubs stuck to their digs. And they realised we're going to be back same time next year trying to get this thing done. But as it sits now, Tim Kelly's got to play out for the Cats next year.
So the difference with the Kelly deal is that he's not a free agent next year. So if you look at Stephen May, Gold Coast turn around and say, well, if we're going to lose him next year, we're only going to get pick 4 or 5 or wherever we finish on the ladder. With Tim Kelly, it's not like that. So it's going to be the same potential trades going to be there next year for wherever West Coast finish on the ladder.
Yep.
And now Geelong have put their stake in the ground, really, and told West Coast, well, we're not going to accept that offer that you offered us in 2018. So you've got to come with something better, bigger and better.
Yeah, I think they've done well.
Yeah. You've got to admire them for...
He's finished second in their best and fairest.
Yeah. Just, too, when you look at it. With, you know, question mark over... It was half a vote, wasn't it, in the end? So so I think you look at it and they've done exactly what they said they were going to do, Geelong, and I think you understand that they, when they set their mind to something, the Cats, they generally see it through and they were always going to see that one through. Mm.
Brisbane Lions, Lachie Neale, Marcus Adams, Lincoln McCarthy go in, Beams and Mays go out. Is that a win for the Brisbane Lions?
I think the Lions have done it. They knew that Beams didn't want to be there anyway, wanted to be elsewhere. I think they've done a great job. Gee, they're going to be a good side. Potentially even next year they can be a really solid side. We know that already, the young talent they've got there, to bring Lachie Neale in there and quite a few other players. I think they're going to be a really good side in 2-3 years, aren't they?
That'd be nice. Yeah, well, speaking of good sides, Melbourne are a good side right now.
They are.
And they've had an interesting couple of weeks as well. Stephen May, Cade Collegiate, Braden Pruce coming in. They lose Hogan, Tyson and Kent. And 23 is their first draft pick. I wonder what Josh Marnie thinks about all that, the footy manager at the D's. He's been good enough to join us. Morning, Josh.
Morning, Harv. How are you, mate?
Going very well. Thank you, buddy. Appreciate your time after, I'm sure, it's been a hectic couple of weeks. Did you get some sleep last night?
Well, the trade period does end up being a lot of sleepless nights. You're going through best scenarios for your club. Points end up going through your head a fair bit. But, really happy in the end of what we were able to do at the end of the trade period. Addressed probably 3 needs that were pretty important for us and got away with a better draft hand. So overall pretty good effort.
The big one, obviously, Stephen May getting that deal done yesterday. Were you always confident that once that Stephen had announced that he was keen to give to Victoria that you were the club that he wanted to come to?
No. we probably didn't know till 10:30 yesterday.
Wow.
He committed to us. So it was, it was a long process, and yeah, we've got a lot of things going on behind the scenes, and then we still haven't got a commitment from Stephen May. It was a difficult one, and it could have probably, nothing could have got done yesterday if he didn't commit, but the way it's all worked out was excellent. We think he's going to be terrific for us. He's exactly the player we need down back. All his characteristics are exactly what we want a Melbourne player to look like, and we can't wait for him to start.
So, Josh, when was he on the radar? Because obviously... to get him in was going to be difficult with your draft position. But when did you start thinking, hang on, this is the one we need to make us much better?
Well, Whitey, we thought he was contracted for 12 months and really didn't think he was on the radar this year. Then there started to be some talk that maybe he was a chance, and that's when we said, OK, let's see if we can get him this year. And probably along with three or four other clubs went in and presented to Steve in the off-season. And then the Jesse Hogan... played out. We thought Jesse was a chance, but again, we didn't commit to Jesse to go into Fremantle. And in reality, if to get the best out of the trade for Jesse Hogan, we thought Stephen May had to come to our club. So they were both related in some way.
Yep.
But it was a very late how it all happened, probably in the off season.
Marnes, Kay Collegeasney feels like it's the steak knives thrown into.
Good steak knives.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to ask. You must be very, very happy to get him into your football club.
Yeah, Ramari was a real focus for us. That's probably a missing link for us, we think. Our run through our midfield. Kay's able to play wing, half back. He's an elite runner. And we thought that what he's been able to do up at Gold Coast early days, had some injury concerns for the last 2 years. But we think he's going to be a really good player for us and exactly what we need for the mix that we've got in our midfield. We've got some really good stoppage players. We think that to be able to have someone on the outside that can run and kick the ball, Kate's going to really add to our midfield.
And we look at Braden Pruce, and we all see Max Gawn, and he virtually plays as a 100% ruckman. What's the plan for Pruce moving forward?
Oh, it's not a concrete plan right now. There's been a lot of discussion about why Braden would have come to Melbourne, and in the end, he said it himself to us. He said he wants to learn under Max Gawn, and that's pretty good to go to a place where there's the best ruckman who Max said to him, I'm committed to making you the best player I can. And I think Braden, he comes to our club, he's going to be learning under Max. He could play as a backup in case Max get injured. He could help us with getting Max through the season, but also we're open-minded to playing both rucks. We've seen that work with West Coast. Whether Max goes forward, whether Braden goes forward, it's really open-minded, but what it has created for us is some options. Last year, we really didn't have any options. It was either Max in the ruck or we'd go for a couple of young ruckmen. So it was really a bit of security for us as a club, but also really open-minded whether we played both rucks.
Josh, Jesse Hogan kicks roughly around 40 goals a year in that sense. How do you replace that and how much pressure is on Wiedemann at the moment?
Good morning, Glenn. I can't answer that question right now. What we back in our forward line is if we get the ball in there, multiple times, over 50 times within a game, but it'll create opportunities. We've seen guys like Jake Nelson step up this year, Christian Petrarca step up, Sam Wiedemann, Tom McDonald. They all play their role within that. It's not about replacing one person getting those goals, but it's, I think we think if our forward line works together, they have a pre-season together, they'll work out what happens in the end.
Were you always resigned to losing him, Marnes?
No. No, it's funny. People think you go through trade period with really definitive answers on things. Right up to yesterday, again, as I said, Stephen May didn't commit to 10:45. It was still the same with Jesse. And that's relationships with players is really important. And Rammer would know. It was a really good conversation with Jesse at the end of the year to say, look, we'll see what we can do. But if in the end it's no good deal for us, you won't be going back. And he was open to staying at Melbourne. We're open to having him playing for Melbourne. And I think that's the only way you can go into trade period, pretty open-minded because things come late. And that's the best way to go about it.
Michael Barlow is looking for another opportunity in the AFL, and he's joined us in studio. After 141 games with the Dockers and the Gold Coast Suns, good morning, Michael.
Morning, Harf. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in, mate. Appreciate your time. Where is your head at the moment? What is your situation officially?
Yeah, so my situation is, well, I've been let go by the Suns some time ago, and
yep,
pretty much just staying fit and active and really healthy and keeping myself ready for an AFL opportunity. But I've said it before, I'm a realist, and I understand that that might not be the reality for me. So I'm preparing as if my AFL career might be over. So I'm looking to what might be next in terms of opportunities. But yeah, whilst these opportunities might come up in delisted free agency or the drafts, I'm keeping an open mind with that.
Are you, this might be a difficult question to answer, but are you surprised you've been delisted by the Gold Coast Suns?
Not really. No, I was quite aware of my situation there for most of the year, I think, when I wasn't getting a game.
And you're having 50 possessions every week.
Yeah, I knew I was on borrowed time a little bit there, which was you know, frustrating for me, because I felt, and I still feel like I sit here as a capable AFL athlete. So that's where my head's at and where my mind's at. And it just, yeah, it just wasn't the right situation at the time, I suppose.
What did the Suns say to you? Why weren't you playing?
Well, yeah, I think early in the year, the discussions from Dewey and the match committee were that the midfielders were going, okay, we started the season really well, which we had a good JLT. I didn't get an opportunity in the JLT as a result of, from what I was told, that they knew what they would get from me. And there were some unknowns coming into the club, probably like Aaron Young, Nick Holman, and they performed really well in the JLT, which is credit to them.
Yep.
So for me, I was probably, I suppose, a bit of a victim of my own consistency across a long time. And then, as I said, the team went well, so the changes wouldn't readily happen. And then I got in about round six and lasted 1 week and was back out, and then had some injury. And so it was a challenging year, but along the way, I suppose you want to know exactly what's going on. And I probably didn't feel like that was coming. The clarity in that wasn't as clear as I probably would have liked.
Now, I just like to say that if Michael Barlow does not get picked up in the next couple of weeks, I'll become an A-League fan and will have no interest in AFL.
A-League?
Well, maybe even E-League. Because I don't understand.
E-sports.
I don't want to embarrass you, but I don't understand someone that can find the football the way you can, was a leader at that football club last year with Gary, you know, particularly for the first half of the year. You had 35 disposals in your last game. There are people that run around in football fields in AFL football and don't touch it six times and get a game because they've got forward-line pressure and all that sort of stuff.
Speed and...
Do you get disenchanted a little bit about what has happened to you? I would imagine it would be hard to stay positive about it all.
Oh, not really. You have moments. Yeah, you have moments where... I had a lot of moments this year throughout the year where I was... mentally not there and having some, you know, some real, I suppose, issues in terms of motivation and commitment to it. But I felt I stuck it out really strongly. But I'm just a big believer. I'm in a really good place with it all. The situation just didn't work for me on the Gold Coast, especially this season. And it's quite clear. You look at what's happened over their trade period and the way the list has again transformed. I've got to understand, you know, it's probably, and they won't mind me saying, they're probably a 5-6 year process now. Yeah. And that takes me to 35 or 36. So you've got to understand that. So where's my best situation? And I'm hoping there's one out there. But as I said before, I feel like I've got the ability. I'm fit, I'm healthy. To play those last two games of the season was really good for me because in my own mind, for the whole year, I sat back not getting the opportunity and thinking, oh, can I still do it? But then I got out there and felt like I contributed really well.
How do you go, Mick? And I've always known you as a real team person, loves the team environment, enjoys the teammates' company. When you know you're better than a player that's playing in the senior team, how do you go mentally with that? And then if that situation's offered to you with potentially another AFL opportunity, how will you go with that?
Yeah, I think the situation going forward, I'll probably answer your last question there first. If I get another opportunity in another club... I understand the circumstance I'm going to go into. If a club's looking to me now, they're probably looking for insurance and a bit of depth. So I'm going in there to probably play that role at the second tier in case, and then you know be there if someone gets injured or if my form warrants it, you know, I go. So this year was a challenge where, yeah, I probably felt I was in the best 22 and wasn't, but I felt like I enhanced for a lot of the time my reputation in terms of being able to mentor younger players. I had great thrill watching guys like, you'll see a guy like Charlie Ballard emerge in the next 2 or 3 years as a really good AFL player. So to be involved with him at the NEFL level and see him get AFL opportunity, I was as excited for him when he got the opportunity halfway through the year as probably, you know, early stages of my career. So that's when you get a bit older and you start to look outwards a lot more. So that's the kind of things that really motivated me this year was helping others.
So if the AFL opportunity doesn't present itself again, what do you want to do? Do you want to stay involved in the AFL system? You've had some horrible injuries over the journey and we'll be able to give some great guidance to some young players coming through, or is it completely, are you going to completely separate yourself from the AFL?
I've got some good ideas with what I want to do. As I said, fit and healthy, so I feel I can still play. So I've actually in principle committed to play and be an assistant coach out at Werribee, 10 years on from when I used to play there. So I've got aspiration in coaching, and you know I really enjoy sport and doing what you guys do. So some media stuff and the welfare stuff you talk about. I've got some discussions going on behind the scenes in some areas I can you know utilize some of my experiences and help others. So I want to fill a few buckets if the AFL thing comes to an end. So as I said, I don't want to rule a line through too much at all. Like the coaching stuff interests me, but how much does it interest me? That's why I want to fill a few buckets over the next couple of years if the AFL stuff is all over.
Can I ask you about the Gold Coast Football Club? In recent years, they've lost Gary Ablett as captain and the best player. And, of course, this year they've lost Tom Lynch and now Stephen May, who are co-captains. So the leadership is absolutely dearth at the Gold Coast Suns. How has that affected the morale of the group, with Gary walking out and knowing basically through the year that Tom was going to go, and then obviously I haven't been there in the last couple of weeks or so, but what Stephen May leaving will do to the group?
I think that they'll rally. Like I think you guys know, being in AFL environments, you really enjoy that aspect of you against the world. I think that's the kind of scenario they're going to approach. I think Dewey and the powers that be up there will embrace that. It'll be like, well, hang on, this is what everyone's saying externally. Well, why can't we rise? And there's some great people there that I really want to go well. Like Dave Swallow, I sit back and watch, and you marvel at what he provides and what he's been through, and you want him to succeed. The Stephen May one, I feel was interesting because he's been a real driver of the club for a long time and really invested. And for the last 6 months, that kind of fell apart a bit. So that one caught me by surprise because he's someone that probably unlike the Gary situation and Tom situation where they'd done some really good service for the club, but it was quite clear they were going to...
Yeah.
The Stephen May one was... he was always within the club and up to his eyeballs and spoke always about, you know, I'm here, I want to see the club go forward, and kind of all happened pretty quickly. So that's a sign that I think they're going to back who they bring in. A lot of those mid-20-year-old players that... will serve a purpose. By no means, I suppose, superstars, but they're going to try and get some people in there to compete and push the club forward. Probably relatively... I've got to wash my words carefully, but it's probably not going to be within the next 6 or 12 months.
Yeah, no, it's a fair way away. And I think we all... They would know that. As you said before, Gold Coast would know that. Anyone who's seen and watched football in the last couple of years would know that, particularly with the exodus of players. But just as on the bigger picture of football on the Gold Coast, do you feel that the support is there for the club to really get what it needs from the community?
Yeah, coming from Freo, it was there were poles apart. I really enjoyed the transition because there's that anonymous feel about when you're a footballer on the Gold Coast. So, but then there's the counter argument. I think that when that happens, when you probably can get away with a little bit more. Not that they're a really good group, so socially no issues, like not that type of stuff, but probably that you can. There's not as much external pressure on players week to week as there is in the city of Melbourne or over in West Australia or South Australia. So I feel that's a challenge they've got. They've got really good people around the club. It'll be what it'll be. I'm not here going to sit here and make any outrageous statements that they're going to. They've got a lot of work ahead of them. That's just what. And I'd probably sit here, having been there 2 years, and that's for me, I feel a bit disappointed because I went up there to make a difference and be involved and push the club forward. And I don't have any regrets. I think I did as well as I could. But I leave the club in a situation where, you know, that they haven't advanced much in the past 2 years at all.
So who's the next leader up there? They obviously
I was thinking about this in the morning.
Yeah, who is it?
Because we lost. I think we've got two left of the leadership. Matt Rosa retired, myself, the two captains. So the rest of the leadership.
Michael Riscatelli was retired by the AFL.
That was quite. I talked to him that night. He's quite funny, but he's just shaking his head. But he's going to get rookie list, which is great. I think Dave Swallow is the obvious. He's a very action-based leader. On game day, he just goes and he competes. And he's quite introverted from Monday to Friday. So that's an area. I think he's the one screaming out that he's the captain of the football. He has to be, in my opinion, be the captain of that football club, and that'll be a statement made in terms of this bloke has been here since the start. He does exactly what we require on game day and Monday to Friday. He'll have to get a little bit more, you know, probably a bit more that ability to talk to the group and motivate. That's not his real go. So then there's Tuke Miller in behind him, who's emerging. And then I think the next kind of guys, Jared Witts is in the leadership group and does a quite a good job. So, I think Dave Swallow will be the next captain. But the leadership group, I think they're going to have to find a few over the next little period.
Deadline for trades was last night, and I'm sure the Hawks were very, very pleased with the hand that they ended up receiving. Graham Wright is the footy director, list manager at the Hawks. He'd been good enough to join us this morning. Good morning, Wrighty.
G'day, Half. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Chad Wingard, Tom Scully, Jack Scrimshaw into the Hawthorn Football Club. Going into the period, did you think you'd be able to land all that?
No, probably would be the short answer. I mean, things change a little bit through the period, and you've always got to be ready to move. And, certainly, I suppose the Tom Scully one was the one that came up a little bit later for us. We understood that Tom had permission to have a look around, but I don't think he'd really locked into doing that until late. And then, obviously, we met with him in the middle of last week, and things moved pretty quickly.
The conversation when it was done, the deal, was that how could the Giants let him go for a fourth-round pick? It's what it's all been about since it's been happening. Were you prepared to pay any more, or was that the deal from the start? It was going to be that sort of pick?
I think initially they wanted something a bit better than that. Obviously, I mean, it's been well documented, that Tom had a significant injury during the year, and obviously there's a little bit of a risk with that, so... That was where the discussion came. We ended on that future fourth-round pick, but a few other things were discussed, obviously. It was just that was the one we ended on, and that was really probably part of bigger deals being done, and I suppose the Giants in a position where they needed to get some money out and that sort of thing. So it might have looked like not that much, but I think from the overall perspective from the Giants, it was a bigger picture scenario.
Do you expect Tom to be playing round one next year?
I'm not sure. Is that Whitey?
Yeah.
I'm not sure, to be honest, man. We'll be hopeful. I think that'd be probably a best case scenario, to be honest. So from our perspective, it'll just be like we are with all of our players. Anyone who might be injured, it's just how they're going and how their body reacts and whether they've got enough work in them to actually be capable of playing at that time. But we won't be aiming for round one. We'll be just aiming for when he's right.
The Chad Wingard one intrigues me because I think you've got an absolute superstar on your hands if you can get him back to the form he was a couple of years ago. How did that happen? Is that something where
Clarko comes to you and say, hey, this is the guy I really want? Or is it more Chad saying he wants to go to Hawthorn? I'm intrigued as to how that all unfolded.
I suppose because he's a contracted player, he has to have permission from Port to explore, really. If he's a contracted player, unless there's been a massive falling out or something like that, and I don't think that was the case. I think it was just that Port were pretty open that they were going to look to do some things during this trade period. And so we met with Chad, and obviously Port knew that he was meeting a couple of clubs. Basically, from there, I think, and I don't want to talk for Chad because I think he's doing a press conference here tomorrow, but I think from there he just felt that this was the place that he could get the best out of himself and get back to being that All-Australian type forward midfielder that we know he's capable of. He's a two-time All-Australian, best and fairest winner at 22 or 23, I think. So at 25, we think he's got a lot of footy ahead of him. And as you said, yeah, really exciting player and can play midfield, can play forward. You know, he's tough and he's hard at the footy, but he's highly skilled as well. So from that perspective, you know, we're really excited to get him on board.
Righty, we always seem to be applauding you at the end of trade period, but do you always get a knock on the door from your recruiting team saying how much they hate you with with your first pick being 53 this year?
Well, I've up until this year, I've been part of that recruiting team, so I've been doing it to myself. this year, it's Mark McKenzie heads up that team with Mark Smart and Jeff Morris, and yeah, they're fantastic at what they do, and they're really well prepared. And I think I said the other day that they'll prepare for 53, our first pick in the draft, like it's pick one. We'll do as much work as we need to do, and I know those guys will be working really hard to make sure we turn that pick hopefully into a decent player. But the reality is, yeah, it's tough on them. But to be honest, they're part of the decision making, so they understand it and they know that what we're trying to do is get better. And sometimes that means we'll give up draft picks. But yeah, it's happened quite a lot.
Adrian Dodoro has done a good job too at the Bombers. It took a very, very long time for the Shield deal to happen, but he got there and he joined us this morning on the Breakfast Club. Good morning, Adrian.
Hey, Daniel, how are you?
Very well, thank you. If the player comfort meter was involved in list managers and recruiting officers yesterday, what was your player comfort meter like at about 6 p.m. last night?
Yeah, it did pretty high. No, you got to have a level head in these situations and been through a fair few of them now over 20 years, actually. So, yeah, you sort of understand what happens on the day, and you've got to keep a level head and have some really good advice around you, which we did, and we got there in the end, which is the important thing.
Was there any fears late in the proceedings yesterday that it wasn't going to happen, that the Giants were hanging on for too much?
I don't know about that. I think when you're in the negotiation, you get a feel for what's going on, and I think we're just both testing each other out, to be perfectly honest, to see how far we were both prepared to go. But I think that, you know, they were genuine, but they were prepared to keep him, as I said last night. And I think they cleared enough money out of their TPP to keep him. So, you know, we had to make a decision, and the decision was we were committed to getting to our club, and we were wrapped that we got him.
A player of this significance, Adrian, how long were you courting Dylan for?
It was post-season. The way Paul Connors operates, he's pretty clear. He doesn't like anyone talking to players in season. It's all done, you know, to a process that he operates, and we fully respect that. So it was probably just after they lost their final, probably a few days after that, that we spoke to him and were part of the process that Paul implemented.
And Adrian, the sort of player you've got, it's well known that you've wanted an extra midfielder. He kind of just fits the bill perfectly. It's just sort of fallen into your lap quite nicely with all the intense negotiations, but the player you've got.
Yeah, you're right, Adam. He was a player that we thought could really help us, and the type of midfielder, because if you look at his numbers, he's in his All-Australian year, his actual inside numbers were better than his outside numbers, and he probably played a bit more wing this year than last year. So we think he's got the right balance, and the way we've developed this team, you know, we're very offensive, but we like to transition defensively, and he's got the ability to do that. Great running power. You know, he'll complement, you know, Dyson Heppel and Zach Merritt and those Zarakis and the boys that we've been building through there for a while. So, yeah, look, he's a good player, and
I think that, it's exciting times ahead.
Make sure you keep your eye on Marvel Stadium on Saturday night as well, because the A-League kicks off for the Victorian team's victory. Host Melbourne City to kick off what's going to be a big campaign for both of those teams, clearly. And the new skipper of Melbourne City has been good enough to join us, Scotty Jamieson, to talk about that and more. Good morning, Scotty.
Good morning, boys.
Great to have you on, mate. It's just around the corner. You've been waiting for this moment for many, many months now, and you've had a lot of training and build-up and practice games and FFA Cups and all that. But when you're on the eve of round one, is it different, and particularly as skipper?
I guess it's just the understanding the process of being 12 weeks of pre-season, and you get to the first game, and it's a different feeling because you've got that game of meaning in a way. The FFA Cup was good, but that wasn't a week-to-week proposition during the pre-season. So, yeah, coming into this week, it's playing for points this weekend. The media obviously kind of up their game in regards to talking about the A-League and Melbourne City in our terms. So it's good. It's good to be back. And as skipper, everything's been good so far.
Are you confident you can get out of the blocks early this season with City?
Oh, look, yeah, I mean, that's the million-dollar question, and you can ask me next week. But I think if you go off just what we've done so far in the preseason, I think it's looking towards we'll have a good start. Our preseason form's been pretty good, albeit we had a disappointing result against Western Sydney where we didn't have to win the game, but we didn't take our chances. It's been pretty good, so starting off that, it bodes well for us, but, come Saturday night, if we don't put into practice what we've worked on, it'll be a real crash landing for us and we'll have to go again. So it's about, just doing what we've done so far and preparing well.
Does playing at Marvel Stadium rather than Amy Park have any effect?
I don't necessarily think it's a disadvantage for us. I think it's maybe a disadvantage for maybe both teams, just in the fact that Amy Park is such a boutique stadium where you have the fans on you, and Eddie had, obviously an AFL ground, bigger capacity. But, I mean, it doesn't take away from the fact that there's an opportunity for more fans to come in. As long as Marvel Stadium gets a good crowd, I think it's a great start and to have the season. But as long as that crowd is a good crowd and a healthy crowd, then I don't see it being a disadvantage at all for both teams. That's for sure.
David Hussey is one of our all-time favourites here on the Breakfast Club. He's a legend in Australian cricket. He's been good enough to join us. Good morning to you, Huss.
Half, thanks for the introduction too. Very kind.
Well, it's just the way it is. It's reality. I'd like to deal with honesty, David. Hey, you're a great batsman, but I want your opinion on this Will Pekowski fella, who yesterday for the Victorian men's cricket team, made 243 runs. He's had a lot of issues with concussion. He's been out of the game for long periods of time with those issues. He comes out yesterday, first Shield game of the year, and makes 243. How prodigious is this talent?
Well, it's a ridiculous performance. Considering what you just mentioned, what he's come back from, he hasn't played any of the JLT Cup leading into it. He just played club cricket and won the Futures 11 game and then going to the Wacker, which is a foreign venue, foreign wicket, and come out and make 240-odd, probably the second time he's played it in Perth, batting at number three, two on a early season wicket. It's phenomenal, really.
So, Huss, forget the runs and how many runs he made. What impressed you most about the innings? Was it the stroke play? Was it his patience? Was it his courage against the short ball? What was it?
Probably two things. Probably more before he actually went out to bat. Just the mental toughness to face all his demons, full well knowing he's gone through all the concussions and one blow to the head puts him out for probably a month to 2 months. So firstly, get over that hurdle and actually bat. And then secondly, just the amount of time he has on the ball. So when the bowler's bowled, he seems to have like an extra second to most normal players. So he makes fast bowlers look medium fast, if that makes sense. It's probably the best way I can describe it.
He's only 20. Is there a sort of a player that you can think of through the years that you can compare with that at that age that is not so much the runs, but a little bit like Rama says, just his batsmanship? Is there someone that you can sort of compare with?
Oh, it's a tough one because you don't really want to put him in the same class as like a Ricky Ponting or a Brad Hodge or a Matthew Elliott, for example.
for mine, I'm just more impressed with, A, he's a quality player. He works exceptionally hard at his game, which you have to these days. If you don't work hard at your game, whoever you are, you just fall by the wayside and move on. But Will's very specific in what he works on, and he works on his weaknesses, and then he works on his strengths as well. So he's very smart in that aspect. But also, and most importantly, he's a fantastic team man, and he'll always profess to doing what the team needs rather than what the team can do for him.
That was the best of The Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.